design, social policy, and technical innovation, which they then imported back home, right, from the laboratory back to the Japan. So what I want to do is complicate some of this work that utilizes this colonial laboratory thesis, which kind of presents the empire as this object, right, this object world for the realization of human ideas, or in my case, the realization of technocratic planning. So this colonial narrative, this colonial laboratory narrative, places the expert at center stage, and therefore reproduces the expert's agency and worldview, which in the political scientist Timothy Mitchell's words, presents the colonies as, you know, dead nature to be conquered by science, or as material reality to be transformed by human ingenuity and technical blueprints. So instead of beginning from the expert's plans and visions and blueprints, I try to analyze the specific practices, conflicts, and negotiations among all these different actors, institutions, and forces in the colonies that went into the making of that laboratory or that blueprint or that expert plan. Moreover, I look at the power relationships, right? The colonial power relationships that made the design and implementation of all these different projects and blueprints possible. So in sum, not only does my work seek to demonstrate how technology operates as a form of power in Japan's empire, but following Mitchell's cue, it also addresses larger questions about how do you write a history that doesn't simply reproduce the binaries of human intelligence over here, nature over here, reason over here, force over here, or imagination over here, real over here. Or in my case, how to write a history that avoids giving technology and expertise a certain coherence and force, right? This progressive force that it normally doesn't have, this privileged position, in other words. Now, to illustrate the relationship between technology and colonial power, I'm going to examine the case of Suppung Dam, or Suiho Dam, built on the Yellow River between Korea and Manchukuo, capable of, as you see here, capable of producing 700,000 kilowatts of electricity and measuring 160 meters tall, 900 meters wide, and 3,110,000 cubic meters in mass. The gravity concrete dam was the second largest in the world after Washington State's Grand Coulee Dam. This was part of a project to build 7 dams along the Yalu River's length that would not only help power the heavy industrialization of Korea and Manchukuo, but also transform the area near the river's mouth into this coastal industrial zone that processed the region's vast iron ore and coal resources, complete with year-round ports, improved transportation links, and modernist cities. When Suppung Dam began producing electricity in 1941, the media proclaimed the dam as a victory for, quote, scientific Japan, right, Kagaku Nihon, which succeeded in transforming the Yalu's eternal flow into electricity or into, quote, the veins of industry. Now, the media also heaped praise on the planning ability and the bold vision of Noguchi Jun, who was the president of Japan Nitrogenous Fertilizer Company, or Nichitsu. You might know this company for Minamata disease later on in the 1960s and 70s. Noguchi Jun headed the Yalu River Hydropower Company, or the media praised the technical skill of Kubota Yutaka, Noguchi's chief dam builder, or they praised the innovation of Japanese engineers who produced the most powerful 100,000 kilowatt turbines and 220 kilovolt transmission lines. The immense project would be the basis for constructing East Asia, which is the title of my book, in the form of future dams on China's Yellow and Yangtze rivers. Thus, since Suppung Dam was prominent within Japan's ideology of developing Asia through technology, and also important for advancing Japanese engineering, I think it serves as a very compelling site to analyze the relationship between technology, expertise, and colonial power. Now, the dam's construction was not merely the taming of a wild river through scientific Japan's power to render it legible for development, but rather this so-called taming, right, this taming of this natural, serene scenery, this taming depended on a scientific and technical expertise, which in turn rested upon a series of very contingent non-scientific practices over time that dynamically created a very new object of calculability, a very new object of knowledge. The government general in Korea only began proclaiming Korea's enormous hydropower potential in the 1920s when it conducted a second 8-year-long hydropower study of its main rivers. as engineers learned more and more about the technologies of large reservoir dams in the late 1910s, they also began acquiring a new way of seeing Korea's rivers as full of potential, full of energy, whereas previously they were Korea's rivers were viewed as entirely lacking. Instead of what the engineers did is instead of measuring just the minimum stream flow, they learned that by measuring the normal stream flow and the maximum stream flow, Korea's rivers could then be more fully harnessed using techniques of damming or diversion. So in other words, this knowledge of Korea as possessing abundant hydropower was not simply discovered through the application of a pre-existing expertise. They had to constantly produce this expertise was constantly produced by a range of actors and forces. Examining how exactly engineers produced this knowledge reveals, I think, that reading the environment was always a very difficult, ambiguous, and contingent process that betrayed the very all these scientific assertions of calculability of Korea's environment. Now, to collect all the data required for the dam's construction or for hydropower construction, engineers utilized the existing network of measurement stations from earlier river studies, as well as built their own to calculate changes in stream flow over time. So first, engineers determined the most promising dam sites based on earlier hydropower and flood control studies, as well as the Army's topographical maps, taking into account weather conditions, topography, geology, forest cover, and estimated dam construction and transmission costs. After they calculated their rough electricity forecasts for each site, they then conducted more on-site investigations into meteorology and hydrometry, and then in the process discovered new sites and established precipitation and stream flow measuring stations at the most promising ones. But due to budget limitations, they could not build as many stations nor conduct the desired number of tests required. For example, they only had one hydrometric station per 1,600 square kilometers, which then forced engineers to make uniform generalizations about stream flow in vast river basins based on sparse data. Now, obtaining the measurements required all these difficult negotiations. For example, concluding formal agreements with other bureaus in the government general to use their stations, selecting and training Koreans who were, quote, somewhat illiterate and had a poor command of Japanese to take daily measurements and submit monthly reports, and entrusting the oversight of Korean observers to local post offices and police stations, which you see a picture of right here. Poor weather and flooding was also a chronic problem, which washed away many of the gauges or prevented teams from reaching remote stations. Korea's rivers were very wide, according to the study, and sometimes tripled in width during the summer rainy season, very much unlike Japan. Thus, engineers were forced to conduct makeshift streamflow measurements using less accurate floating hydrometers or just rely on local hearsay to determine maximum water levels. Finally, just to collaborate their various instruments, their water velocity gauges, required the building of a special gauge inspection facility near Seoul to arrive at a uniform stream flow coefficient. In other words, the coefficient that the device's efficiency at allowing the fluid to flow through it. So using this sedimentation tank at a water treatment facility, engineers built a 48-meter-long track for a special rail car equipped with a velocity gauge that reached into the tank, which you see right here. So by moving this rail car at different speeds and then taking readings on the gauge, they arrived at a universal coefficient for the devices that would then uniformly measure all of the stream flow across Korea. So in sum, the environment, in other words, my point here is the environment didn't just lie dead outside of all these practices, ready to be measured and shaped by Japanese expertise. It was actively constituted through many contingent, extra-scientific, non-scientific processes, such as what I just described, right? Selecting and training Koreans to report measurements, making a very erratic and unfamiliar environment conform to new knowledge and devices, like this, and building a special facility to anchor the new forms of measurement. As we'll see, these various practices of establishing legibility would have continuing consequences for Sipung Dam's construction. Now, engineering the dam was a messy, uncertain, conflict-ridden, and very haphazard process, which betrayed the whole discourse of scientific Japan taming the colonial frontier. The dam's construction began in 1937, the same year the war began throughout Asia. In addition to facing chronic labor and material shortages from the expanding war, the unpredictable summer rainy seasons created the most problems for the engineers. Although earlier hydrometric studies had prepared engineers for some flood damage, the sudden water level rises continuously defied their scientific data. So for example, summer floods in 1940, pictured right here, overflowed the finished portions of the dam 5 times, washing away 8 steel construction towers and flooding the power station and gravel pits. Since 5 of the 7 turbine intakes were not built high enough over the unexpectedly high water levels, the reservoir had to be lowered for short periods of times in future years to complete their construction. This, of course, resulted in electricity suspensions from the 2 finished higher intakes and turbines, which affected wartime production. Future summers were no better as worker and engineers constantly mobilized to repair flood damage, ultimately causing a 2-year delay in the dam's construction. One engineer aptly captured the tension and the contingency and the uncertainty involved in managing the river when describing the construction's most difficult procedure, which is simultaneously closing the central floodgates, floodgates right here, at the height of the flood season in the summer in preparation for electricity production. The engineer stated this, and I quote, "When the 3 gates were closed on top of the ferociously flowing and foaming water, all eyes stopped blinking for a few minutes. Once we breathed a sigh of relief, however, the water began leaking with a vengeance. We threw all of our cotton blankets on them, but to no avail. The water pressure gradually increased. It was like children covering water faucets with their hands to block the leaks. We had to throw in rocks and whatever available inside and outside the gates, and when finally the water pressure decreased, all of us thanked the gods." So apparently the concrete, the 2-year-old concrete near the floodgates, was damaged from constant river debris, and the waterproofing was very insufficient, which led to leaks at 20 tons per second. At the construction's beginning, engineers spent 1 year experimenting with different materials to produce the right cement for the frigid winter climate, since normal cement cracked in the minus 30 degree temperatures, and low temperature cement lost its strength in other seasons. Yet they continuously had trouble producing the proper cement to deal with the river's very unpredictable force and the region's particular climate, especially during the wartime material shortages. While engineers presented all of these various issues within a larger narrative of Japanese science patiently resolving each problem it encountered one by one, it's very clear from the accounts that it was not science and technology that directed the engineers' work as this kind of preformed intelligence. Rather, the project itself formed the expertise. So in other words, solutions were kind of haphazardly worked out on the ground, and expertise was given shape through all of these constant negotiations with the environment. So in other words, Japanese expertise was very hybrid, rather than this exterior intelligence applied to the world, which is how expert discourse typically presented itself in the context of the empire. Japanese officials also promoted the dam's influence on regional industrial development. The local Chamber of Commerce proclaimed this in 1941. It said this, "The ballad of the lumber raft has been transformed into the roar of the hydropower turbine." Yet the affected lumber industry and the local politicians also employed the same language of development to shift the discourse, since the dam would seriously disrupt the region's economy. Every fall, people cut down the coniferous forest, and in the spring floated the lumber downriver on these kinds of rafts. On the Korean side alone, 30,000 people were engaged in cutting down trees and transporting them. In the peak spring season, around 1 million cubic meters floated downriver to Andong and Sinmiju, where 2 large Japanese companies processed most of it. From the beginning, representatives of the lumber companies and workers demanded guarantees of non-obstruction, which is incorporated into Yalu Hydropower's permit. Against the claims of hydropower's benefits for industrial development, the lumber people and the companies asserted the strategic importance of wood and paper products for Japan's war economy, and insisted on the duty of the company and the state to protect the lives of the region's inhabitants, the livelihoods, I should say, of the region's inhabitants. So in response, Yalu Hydropower immediately began designing 6 special logging channels through the dam, despite serious doubts about being able to calculate proper inclines to facilitate the varying unpredictable water pressures. This is one of the special logging channels. But by late 1939, when they began closing the central portion of the river, engineers were still unable to resolve technical issues, resulting in the lumber being damaged and breaking up in the channels. In other words, they were a complete failure, and the effect on the industry was devastating. Here you can see kind of backup because it was of the lumber at the gates. Kubota, who was the managing director, apologized to an angry meeting of industry representatives and local politicians, promising to correct the technical problems. However, on another occasion, he stated that sacrifice was unavoidable when hydropower was national policy. Finally, in February 1942, after 3 years of petitions to the government general, threats of mass rallies, and tense negotiations between the company, the provincial governor, and lumber interests, a deal was made whereby factories were purchased and relocated inland near railways. Whereas the two Japanese companies received special consideration, Korean and Chinese operators received little compensation, and the industry was eventually consolidated into one special company. So in sum, whereas the company and state officials emphasized the dam's benefits for promoting heavy industry, regional lumber interests and assemblymen attempted to expand that discourse to include discussions of balanced development and rights to livelihood. While the company really attempted to resolve the issue by employing the same faith in technology and scientific Japan that embodied the whole project when they designed all these channels, this effort failed, leading to a very hasty settlement. At the dam's opening ceremony in 1941, a few officials mentioned this dispute. However, they framed it as one of many problems that Japanese technology was successfully resolving, or simply emphasized the benefits of future industrialization. So thus, my point here is that visions of development not merely brought in and applied, these visions of development were not only, merely brought in and applied by Japanese experts, but they arose amongst this very contentious interplay of interests in the colonies that then also tried to alter these visions and expertise. Now, to emphasize the unstable nature of scientific Japan or technocratic ideas of Asian development, let me introduce this 5-part travelogue written in January 1940 by Kang Ik-sung, who was the local branch head for the Korean newspaper Mansum Ilbo, or Manchuria Korean News, as authorities made final preparations to relocate the 70,000 residents of a 200 square kilometer area forming the dam's reservoir. This travelogue not only gives us a glimpse of Korean reactions to the project, but also some of the authorities' methods of persuasion. The writer is clearly restricted as he's escorted by police officers in Sokju County, warned by a Changsong district head to be careful in his reporting, and banned from taking photographs there. While Kang is openly supportive of the project, his account is tinged with a sadness about the area's disappearance and the loss of homes and livelihoods. For example, after documenting compensation levels in one Korean district and discussing how landowners complained about them as not reflecting market prices, as not including housing structure and crop value, and as insufficient to maintain their livelihoods, Kang writes this. He says, "I believe that as citizens of a nation that is building the power plant as a glorious foundation for the new construction of a greater East Asia, they, the residents who are displaced, should not feel the need to complain anymore." Yet the article also has this rather poetic headline: steep mountains and peaks, silky green farmlands extending in front of farmhouses, all but a momentary dream. Oh, how powerful science and technology is. So thus, my point here is, in contrast to the Japanese media's grand proclamations about the power of technology to construct and modernize East Asia, this Korean reporter subverts the meaning of science and technology to mean destruction, impermanence, and ephemerality. On the river's Manchurian side, he introduces a Korean member of the Manchukuo Concordia Association, which is the mass party whose mission was to mobilize all of the different ethnicities under the banner of Pan-Asian harmony. Mr. Che, and this is very grainy because of the newspaper, Mr. Che was the director of the residence pacification office, and the reporter describes his activities as follows, Mr. Chen's activities. So we, Mr. Chen and his group, have been touring the villages to educate the listless residents who are worried about their future without realizing the importance of hydropower in the development of Greater East Asia prosperity by showing films depicting the world-famous work of the Yalu River hydropower plant's great construction. Mr. Che and other officials were able to comfort the residents and ensure their smooth relocation. But the reporter, however, ends the article on Manchuria like this. He ends like this. He says, "For those villagers who had to desert their beloved homes and livelihoods to join relocation groups and look for new ones, it would be impossible to understand the national policy of building a prosperous Asia. To them, it was only a matter of their own life's disaster. Vacant homes demolished, whole villages completely vacant. Truly sad scenes." He continues, "Wind was blowing towards me in the freezing cold weather. My eyes were filled with images of the vagabond villagers on their way to being relocated. At this sight, my body quickly began generating a strange heat." So thus, as both governments in Manchukuo and Korea were loudly proclaiming technology as the basis for Asian prosperity and development, this Korean reporter's account reveals an attempt by the colonized to kind of appropriate that discourse and contest its meaning. The discourse of scientific Japan, again, was inherently unstable, an instability that isn't often captured in narratives about colonial expertise, except as these very small bumps on the road to progress or implementation. So as I've been trying to emphasize, the entire project is more than just the application of a very confident expertise, but also required the invocation of multiple forms of colonial power, legal power, police power, administrative power, economic power, ideological power. From their beginnings, Manchukuo and Korea established eminent domain laws and administrative processes for the approval of projects, which included an obligation to negotiate with and compensate the affected parties. However, these laws were more streamlined than Japan's laws and lacked all these checks and balances. So, for example, in Korea's law, there was no true third-party mediation, no mechanisms for dispute resolution beyond appealing to the same authorities, and no language on fair compensation. The inequitable nature of the law, however, did not prevent its contestation by the residents. So, for example, out of concern for the success of future dam projects, the Pyeongan-pukto provincial governor urged the Yalu Hydropower Company to let the government, or the local government, form a compensation committee to manage negotiations after receiving many petitions and complaints about the company's backhanded tactics of, for example, using old tax records to lower the land values, or employing Korean middlemen to intimidate or cheat residents, and cheaply buying out landless tenants to pressure the wealthier landowners. In the end, the governor used a mixture of law, bureaucratic procedure, and force, conducting a more detailed land investigation and holding public meetings, while at the same time banning protests and using police to intimidate uncooperative landowners. Under the policy of using Koreans as this colonial vanguard in Manchuria, residents were settled into these collective villages, like you see right here, which were run by development companies. So for example, some of the resettled were put to work building dikes and reclaiming swamplands for agricultural development programs in northern Manchuria, northern Manchukuo. As part of the immigration process, they were issued all these permits confirming their political purity and educated to become these model citizens of the new multi-ethnic Manchukuo. Some were also settled into so-called safety villages as part of the Kwantung Army's counterinsurgency campaigns. These safety villages were large settlements of resettled Korean refugees used to create economically viable bases for the control of the Manchurian countryside. So in these safety villages, residents were subject to a high maintenance taxes, rents, and interest payments on agricultural loans imposed by the development companies. So in short, the dam's construction was not simply this isolated project carried out by engineers and experts, but required the simultaneous use of overlapping forms of power that were essential to the entire colonial enterprise, things like collective immigration programs, agricultural development projects, and counterinsurgency campaigns. An astonishing 25 million workers worth of manpower, not 25 million individual, but worth of manpower, were used over the 7-year construction period. So it's around 10,000 per day of manpower at its peak between 1941 and 1942. The labor came from three sources. First, the government general in Korea established the government assignment system to secure workers from the more populated south of Korea to the less populated north to work in construction, mining, transportation, and industry. Provinces and districts all throughout Korea were given quotas, and officials aggressively recruited poor, landless Korean farmers by making all these false wage promises, taking advantage of the natural disasters, enlisting patriotic organizations, and of course, using police pressure. The second source, Chinese labor brokers, and these were usually landed elites with a wide network of relatives and patrons. These were also very necessary to secure the large amounts of labor. Construction companies, in this case Hazamagumi and Nishimatsugumi, paid lump sums to these brokers who in turn secured foremen who then paid the wages, loans, transportation, and upkeep of groups of 15 to 90 workers. Finally, nearby residents forced into walled strategic hamlets or safety villages as part of the Kwandong Army's counterinsurgency campaigns were employed, many of whom, of course, had no other choice because they were deprived of their livelihoods. So thus, while Japanese officials celebrated the efforts of 25 million so-called industrial warriors and even made comparisons to Egypt's ancient pyramids, securing the labor required the employment of different forms of colonial power, such as national labor mobilization campaigns, Chinese labor brokers utilizing their semi-feudal power relations, and of course, military force. Now, policing and managing the workers received serious attention from the construction's beginning. The area was heavily guarded since Yang Jingyu's Northeast Anti-Japanese United Army and the Kim Il-sung Division operated nearby, prompting a 3-year campaign by the Manchuria's Guangdong Army. As the number of Chinese workers increased, authorities became particularly worried about so-called impure elements, posing as workers to organize and recruit. Two policemen patrolled the construction site, housing areas, and villages at all times of the day. Officers also compiled a worker register and conducted frequent identity sweeps, making more detailed inquiries into the backgrounds of suspicious persons. Bunkhouses had signs with the occupants' names, and foremen were required to report all the movements and changes that happened in each bunkhouse. Good morals and manners were taught at neighborhood association and worker meetings in response to a rise in gambling, theft, and prostitution, and to promote a spirit of ethnic harmony among these very transient workers. And I couldn't find pictures from Supong Dam. This is from another large dam in Manchukuo called Thunman Dam, or Homan Dam. Now, government reports show that many Korean workers mobilized through the government assignment system were subject to training in work, discipline, and thrift, and often ran away. One group of 1,200 Korean workers in 1938 were described as having a, quote, vacation-like mood, and only 326 of them stayed and worked hard enough to send money back home. The construction companies therefore turned to using more Chinese migrant labor. Some concern was shown about worker discontent over high prices and working conditions, but the response was limited to efforts at creating harmony, quote-unquote harmony, between capitalist, government official, and worker, or campaigns to encourage good manners, hard work, and thrift. Living and working conditions were quite terrible, according to worker accounts. Construction occurred night and day, with laborers doing continuous 12-hour shifts, and frequent accidents and communicable disease a serious problem. Japanese supervisors were only concerned about speed and cursed or hit the workers when the pace slackened. Sabotage, or pretending to work hard when the foreman was watching and just working half-heartedly when he was not, was a common tactic. So we can therefore add techniques of violence, surveillance, management, and mobilization to all of these elements of colonial power that form the conditions for the exercise of technical expertise. Now, just to elaborate on this notion of comprehensive development, which I'm trying to get at, so comprehensive development is not just the building of a dam for one purpose of electricity production, it's building a dam for flood control, for urban development, for port construction, for multiple purposes that contribute, that mutually enhance each other. So let me just talk about the Supun Dam's other parts of the project, because this border region around the Yalu River, this region I'm talking about here, this is known as, in Japanese, as Tohendo, or in Chinese, Dongbiandao in Manchuria, or Pyongan-pukto in Northern Korea, witnessed Japan's first instances of what became known as national land planning, so Japanese, Kokudo Keikaku, which developed during the wartime in the 1940s, and especially prospered in Japan's post-war high-speed growth era. Now, Kokudo Keikaku, national land planning, emerged during the war in response to global trends in regional planning to alleviate urban overcrowding since the 1920s, and German also arose out of German concepts of Raumordnung, or spatial order, during the 1930s, which emphasized curbing urban growth, evenly distributing industrial zones, and preserving rural areas in line with national defense objectives of achieving economic self-sufficiency. From 1935, Japan's home ministry engineers began researching land planning abroad and helped formulate the administrative and legal apparatus, culminating in the outline for the establishment of land planning, of national land planning, in 1940. So this idea of the state rationally organizing industry, agriculture, population, socio-cultural institutions, and infrastructure for comprehensive development, however, of course, was not just formulated in the minds of these bureaucrats or experts who were applying the latest Western planning techniques, but as I've been trying to argue, also emerged from the ground up, on the ground, through specific projects in Japan's empire, where engineers and bureaucrats were devising all these notions of comprehensiveness, or in Japanese, sogosei, right, during the 1930s, in the form of river control projects, multi-purpose dam construction, and industrial policy. Supun Dam's construction, and also Fengman Dam's construction and other dams, actually made the formation of national land planning possible through the planning and construction of a related project, the Daitoko Coastal Industrial, the Dadong Coastal Industrial City Plan, which was near Andong on the Manchukuo-Korea border. So here's Supun Dam. This coastal industrial zone would lie around here. That would be very much connected to the dam. So in a very similar fashion that I did with Supun Dam's construction, I'll just discuss a little bit of the specific practices, conflicts, and negotiations among all these different actors and institutions and forces in the colonies, as well as these different power relations that went into the formation of national land planning, to show how techno-scientific planning discourse really tries to naturalize itself as a very coherent, rational, and transcendent progressive force. Now, just to get into the story, right? Japanese engineers at the Andong provincial office, right, Andong City on the Manchukuo side, which is the province that bordered Korea, originally lacked a framework for what would become referred to as the Greater Andong Comprehensive Industrial Region. Previously, engineers had conducted more limited urban planning in Andong City along the lines of Manchukuo's very famous garden city style projects aimed at introducing strict zoning laws and constructing ample green belts and parks for urban hygiene and health. Although the old trade and lumber port began receiving attention in 1935 due to discovery of abundant natural resources, the announcement of a new Dongbiandao railway and plans to develop Supun Dam nearby, Andong's port had become increasingly dysfunctional as a result of sedimentation from lumbering upriver. And this is a factor that really hindered its future industrial development. Kuroda Shigeharu, Andong's head engineer, noted that Guangdong army officers began proclaiming Andong's golden age of industrialization in 1937 after the passing of Manchukuo's five-year industrial plan and the beginning of Supun Dam's construction. When Kuroda, the local engineer, was ordered to investigate sites for an industrial port, local engineers concluded that the area was only suitable for small fishing ports and pushed instead for a very limited plan to renovate Andong's existing port. In a visit to Shinkyo, or Changchun, which was the capital of Manchukuo, in 1838 to win approval, Andong engineers met with Kishi Nobusuke, right, the famous prime minister after the war, whose grandson is prime minister. a leading reform bureaucrat and vice, Kishi was a leading reform bureaucrat and vice director of Manchukuo's industrial department, who urged the local engineers to conduct wider investigations in light of the plans to locate factories of Ayukawa Yoshisuke's Manchurian heavy industries to utilize the region's coal and iron resources. After further discussions with reform bureaucrats and government engineers, Kuroda and his team were gradually won over to Kishi's larger vision and began criticizing their early narrowness in planning. Once the local engineers began thinking about comprehensive links with natural resources, industry and ports, and hydropower and urban planning, they expanded their investigations using local guides and discovered a promising anchoring point and large plain 30 kilometers southwest of Andong that was suitable for a large port and industrial zone. So this is this Daitoko port area that they discovered. Thus, comprehensive land planning emerged in this context of clashes and negotiations between provincial officials who were thinking about local development and reform bureaucrats at the top seeking to transform Manchukuo into this heavy industrialized total war state. As the project was finalized in 1939, state reform bureaucrats began formulating the comprehensive location plan of 1940, which was a set of national land planning guidelines designed to rationally coordinate all of the agricultural and industrial distribution, the emigration, and the natural resource development in order to kind of avoid the overlap and conflict between all these different projects. It's in this context that this Dadong project, or the Daitoko project, was a concrete microcosm at the regional level for the development of national land planning conceptions at the state level or the national level. Now, under this emerging framework of comprehensiveness, right, Andong engineers delineated a 215 square kilometer comprehensive coastal industrial region around the proposed port for urban planning, noting how its proximity to abundant natural resources, transportation links, cheap land and labor, and ample hydropower and industrial water would reduce business costs by 10%, thereby increasing national productivity. Those of you who've been to Japan know these coastal industrial zones, right? You get out, you know, you go along the Shinkansen, right? You'll see these really ugly coastal industrial zones. A lot of them have their roots in these projects. So the plan created, this Daitoko plan, created three town centers along a rectangular urban planning zone stretching 30 kilometers along the Yalu River. The coastal industrial urban region would house 1 million residents, 2 million if you counted Andong City and surrounding areas. The port would accommodate 4,000 ton ships and 2 million tons of goods per year. The large factory lots were to be built adjacent to the river or on reclaimed land and equipped with their own docks, connecting roads, and adequate electricity and water. Mangyo or Manchuria heavy industry subsidiaries alone plan to invest 1 billion yen to produce 500 million yen of goods per year. And at one point, the Ford Motor Company sent an inspection team and unsuccessfully applied for a factory site. Large green belts were incorporated to control sprawl and allow for sufficient agriculture, while a variety of pedestrian parkways, recreational and children's parks were included to alleviate the effects of air pollution and provide for the people's health and leisure. A 17 kilometer long, 25 meter wide superhighway, the first in Asia, modeled after Hitler's Autobahn, was planned along the outskirts to connect the town areas. And when completed, cars could travel at 120 kilometers per hour and make the trip from the port to Andong City in 15 minutes. So the highway would be along the outskirts right there. Montetsu, the railway, was also constructing 35 kilometers of railway to connect the towns and allow travel between them in 10 minutes or less, and ultimately link up with its international network. A kind of grid, a road network, which you kind of see right here, was formed around one main wide central avenue running through the industrial zones of each town, and green belts were planted on either side of all roads over 40 meters wide to control growth and to set them apart from industrial, residential, and commercial areas. A special entertainment area was planned at a hot springs, an onsen, on the outskirts right over here to counter the effects of heavy industrialization, which included hotels, an amusement park, athletic fields, sanatoriums, restaurants, shopping centers, and so on. Thus, Japanese urban planners both utilized these garden city-inspired techniques that they employed in the capital, like in Shinkyo, while building on them to design a very comprehensive regional unit, integrating heavy industry, agriculture, transportation, national defense, public health, and people's livelihoods. But despite all these bold assertions of technocratic expertise, the comprehensive plan was, again, not very grounded in any kind of firm technical data when presented to the Manchukuo authorities. Just to give you an example, Naoki Rintaro and Haraguchi Chujiro, who were two of Manchukuo's top engineers, led a mission in February 1939, pictured right here, to investigate icing conditions at the port site during the winter. Although these engineers confidently concluded that this was a year-round warm water port, the investigation was only based on 2 weeks of temperature and weather measurements, a few pictures of the area from earlier years, and a visual confirmation that the tides flushed out and broke up the ice from upriver, which again shows a lot of the guesswork behind the investigation. As it turned out, future studies proved that their conclusions were correct, but for totally unforeseen reasons, as the construction of the Suppung Dam upriver unexpectedly raised the river's water temperature and reduced the ice flow. These engineers' investigations also revealed future difficulties, such as an abundance of shallow zones in the proposed shipping lanes that required massive dredging and the building of diversion levees to maintain sufficient depths for these huge ships, and also the soil's weak qualities, which required engineers to build raised foundations before constructing any kind of building structure. In coordination with the Daitoko project, Korean government general engineers, on the other side, drew up their own comprehensive regional plan across the river in Sinwiju and Tasari Island, grounding it in a very rough method that calculated electricity output per unit of land. So what they did is, based on this estimated 500 to 600,000 kilowatts from Suppung Dam, the Korean engineers arrived at a figure of 50 kilowatts per square meter. Then they determined the size of various heavy industrial and residential zones, making rough comparisons to smaller industrialized areas in Japan, like Kitakyushu, or the new industrial city of Hungnam in Korea. This method that the engineers in Korea used departed from earlier urban planning techniques, which just consisted of filling out these details with different zones. So in sum, whereas engineers presented their data as proof that proof of the project's feasibility and framed potential problems as resolvable through their expertise, you know, such all these techniques of representation really disguised all these on the ground ambiguity, contingency, and uncertainty that was at the heart of their technocratic conceptions, which then made their plans look very stable and coherent. Business interests also shaped conceptions of regional and national land planning emerged out of the project. Ayukawa, who was head of the Mangyo, which was, of course, as you probably know, the conglomerate that was formed out of Nissan, Mangyo was charged with realizing Manchuria's planned industrial targets. And Ayukawa, who is head of Nissan Mangyo, proclaimed that his business would live forever in Andong when he inspected the area. Ayukawa was attracted by the cheap electricity, land and labor, and its proximity to a port, since these enabled the mass automobile and aircraft production he required to achieve economies of scale. The assembly plants would be connected to a network of materials, casting, machinery, and parts factories, as well as supplied with coal and iron ore from one of its other regional companies, Tohendo Development. Amplifying Ayukawa's enthusiasm, one engineer said this: "In my dreams, I see the day of East Asian construction and the majestic sight of countless giant ships loaded with goods bearing the label Made in Manchukuo as they sail across the Yellow Sea Lake and over thousands of miles of waves towards every corner of the earth." An unexpected rush of factory applications led to an oversubscription of the land in the zoned area, and two expansions of the original plan to reharmonize or rejig the various aspects of regional urban planning. You know, the different zones for industry and housing, the green belts, the water provisioning areas, the transport. But later, as the planners faced budget cuts and material shortages from the war, they shifted from this idea of balancing all these different zones towards prioritizing the Mongyo heavy industrial areas and the port infrastructure. By the war's end, they built several Mongyo factories, which began production, finished the unpaved portion of the superhighway and 13 kilometers of the railway, planted trees for the greenbelt, completed the dock foundations and one operational dock, and began dredging and building levees for the shipping lanes. So in sum, expert plans were, again, always fluid, always changing, unstable, as engineers continuously balanced their emerging frameworks of comprehensive regional planning with very specific demands from business and Manchuria's total war economy. Now, similar with the case of Supung Dam, engineers described the project as the transformation of a virgin frontier, virgin land, and celebrated their ability to freely plan and implement their ideas based on what they called the essence of modern technology. These assertions of the progressive, transformative nature of technology, however, as I've been saying all along, hit all these messy, uncertain, and conflict-ridden aspects of the project. Before this Daitoku plan was formulated, Manchukuo authorities actually settled on another site, Tasari Island, as the site for their comprehensive plan and as the primary export base for the region's natural resources. The Korea government general responded then with a six-year port improvement plan in 1938 to facilitate 1 million tons of freight per year and accommodate 3,000 ton ships. However, Andong engineers on the other side of the river pushed for port improvement and industrial development in their province. They also criticized the plan for leaving Andong behind and ignoring its own attractive qualities, such as abundant industrial land and cheap labor. At around the same time, the Korean government general obstructed Andong's earlier plan to renovate its port through river improvement by calling for an investigation on flood control effects, in other words, using these delay tactics. The discovery of this Daitoku and the finalization of this coastal industrial plan that I've been talking about, however, again, didn't put an end to all the tensions on both sides. As all these government officials constantly repeated slogans of co-prosperity in response to local worries that these competing ports would overlap with each other too much and therefore be detrimental to their economies. The Korean government general even delayed approval for the project until given assurances that it would not affect Korea's regional development plans. Mantetsu also, which was the rail conglomerate that had a 30-year history as the main infrastructure developer in Manchuria, also resisted the project in the beginning, since it threatened the important role of Daiden, which is more to the south, and more broadly signified a power shift away from Mantetsu towards state planners in Mongyo. Thus, as state officials formulated their comprehensive regional plans, they also had to continuously manage all these different criticisms of the projects, economic benefits, and cater to these different powerful institutions, such as Mantetsu and the Korean government general. Now, the comprehensive plan also relied, like in Supung Dam, of course, on the exercise of various forms of power over the course of its implementation. In a 1939 speech to Andong's Concordia Association, the engineer Naoki Rintaro criticized the popular view that building ports and other infrastructure would automatically bring about development and prosperity, citing his earlier experiences constructing Osaka's port, which was underutilized for years due to, of course, Kobe's popularity. Naoki urged residents to engage in what the British called back then selling the port, or mobilizing themselves to open shops, provide services, build amusement facilities, and actively market the port's benefits to Japan and the world, rather than assuming that advanced infrastructure and technology would automatically attract shippers and other businesses. In short, Naoki argued to the residents that technology did not exist in a socio-political vacuum, but required coordinated ideological campaigns and social mobilization as well. So efforts such as the residents' establishment of a committee in 1935 to successfully campaign for a new railroad and their success in attracting more factories than available land attest to a certain degree of mobilization among the residents around technology. Now, purchasing land from the thousands of landowners also required new strategies of power and shaped expert plans as well. After only purchasing 27% of the land in 2 years, Andong province then issued these bonds to the resisting Chinese landlords, which paid 3% interest until the city leased or sold the zone, all these zoned lands, to the new tenants. By 1943, 83% of the land was purchased through this financial technology as a way to kind of co-opt local dissent. In Korea, the government general changed its town area planning order in 1938 to expand the scope of eminent domain price controls and allow for the purchase of much larger land tracts for industrial development. This was done, of course, against the backdrop of fierce protests by landowners affected by the construction of nearby Supung Dam against all those low land valuations, inadequate relocation arrangements, and backhanded tactics of the hydropower company. Korea's top civil engineer, Shin Bak-ho-hae, expressed a sense of urgency in drawing up regional industrial plans and laws, since the rise of land values was making large-scale public works projects very expensive and difficult, as was already the case in Japan. The Sinuiju Tasari plan in Korea was announced in three separate parts in 1939 to disguise the project's immense scale, since the Korean government feared the public outcry over the unprecedented seizure of more than 200 square kilometers of land. So again, comprehensive land planning was not just about experts creating all these, you know, rational and optimal relations between cities and regions or industry and natural resources, but also, more importantly, about extending colonial power over territory and co-opting struggles over land and livelihood. So in conclusion, an analysis of Supung Dam and the accompanying Daitoku coastal industrial zone reveals much about, I think, the Japanese colonial enterprise in general and this prominent discourse of constructing Asia, right? Towa Gensetsu, which is often dismissed as empty rhetoric. While a growing body of research has shown that science and technology was an essential part of Japan's colonial enterprise, I think there's a need for more work that goes beyond all of those blue plans and blueprints of engineers, businessmen, and bureaucrats. I've argued that, you know, just staying at this, relying on their materials of the engineers, businessmen, and bureaucrats can lead to a reproduction of the narrative of expertise overcoming nature, which was itself an essential technique of Japanese imperial power and later post-war development discourse. Expertise, again, was never this preformed intelligence or blueprint applied within a colonial laboratory, but rather both were very messy effects produced by a range of practices, negotiation, and conflicts involving many actors, institutions, and forces. This effect, right, of technical expertise developing the colonial frontier was constantly actively produced by focusing on just the technical charts, the graphs, and the data that rendered the environment transparent, rather than the extra scientific practices, the contingencies, and the ambiguities that went into the making of those calculations. It was made transparent, and rational by presenting the difficulties that the engineers encountered within an uncooperative environment as non-human externalities to be overcome through their confident intelligence, rather than as a fundamental part of their hybrid expertise. The rational blueprint, the stable blueprint, was also created by marginalizing all these alternative discourses and downplaying conflicting interests that challenged the stability and coherence of their visions. And this blueprint, this nightly blueprint, was also created by eliminating discussion of the multiple forms of colonial power that made their projects possible. Thank you.